Today's show will be on case 6 in the Momongkan, the Wumankuan. Case 6 is entitled, The Buddha Holds Out a Flower. When Shakyamuni Buddha was at Mount Gridhrakuta, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent. Only Mahakashapa broke into a broad smile. The Buddha said, I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, and the subtle Dharma gate, independent of words and transmitted beyond doctrine. This I have entrusted to Mahakashapa. Humon's comment. Golden-faced Gautama really disregarded his listeners. He made the good look bad and sold dog's meat labeled as mutton. He himself thought it was wonderful. If, however, everyone in the audience had laughed, how could he have transmitted his true eye? And again, if Mahakashapa had not smiled, how could the Buddha have transmitted it? If you say the true eye of Dharma cannot be transmitted, then the golden-faced old man would be a city slicker who cheats the country bumpkins. If it cannot be transmitted, then why did the Buddha approve of Mahakashapa? Mumon's verse, holding out a flower, the Buddha betrayed his curly tail. Heaven and earth were bewildered at Mahakashapa's smile. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen today. This is a quite famous koan in the Zen tradition. The story is that, it's actually historically correct that when the Buddha would deliver teachings, he would sometimes go up to Vulture Peak, and people would follow him up. So when the Buddha was on his way up to Vulture Peak, monks and nuns who lived along the way, or lay men and lay women, would see the Buddha with some of his followers, and they would put their work aside, and they would follow him up the mountain. So, you know, as the Buddha was moving up the mountain towards Vulture Peak, he would be picking up an audience. And by the time he got to Vulture Peak, there would be a fairly large crowd. At least this is the common belief. And in this very dramatic setting, the Buddha would often deliver teachings. And people would listen attentively, and then the Buddha would descend, and people would go back to their lives. So people were quite used to this routine. You know, if you saw the Buddha walking up towards Vulture Peak, you knew he was going to deliver a talk, and you'd put everything away and go with him. But on this occasion, things were a little strange. You know, the Buddha started walking up Vulture Peak, and people gathered after him. And when he got to the top of the peak, everybody sat down. They all knew the drill. And then he didn't say anything. You know, and people wait politely and wait. And no discourse, no sutra. And finally, after some time, the Buddha simply holds up a flower. It says he holds up a flower to his listeners. So they're waiting to hear, and he shows them this flower, and people don't know how to respond. You know, they really don't know what to make of this. They're waiting for a discourse. The sutra says that only Mahakashapa Everybody else is sort of looking puzzled as the Buddha holds up this flower. Only Mahakashyapa broke into a big smile. Then the Buddha said to the, then the Buddha began to speak. And what he said was, I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, and the subtle Dharma gate, independent of words and transmitted beyond the doctrine. This I have entrusted to Mahakashyapa. So this story is quite famous because in Zen, we believe that you're really not authorized to be a teacher unless you've been given permission to do that by your own teacher. So there's something in Zen called Dharma transmission. Dharma transmission. So, you know, theoretically, all teachers in Chan, in the Zen school, have ties going back to this moment. So every teacher of Zen has been authorized to teach by his teacher, who has been authorized to teach by his teacher. And if you could trace it all back, it would go back to this moment where Mahakashyapa smiles at the Buddha holding up his flower. And at that moment, the Buddha is said to have given him transmission. Transmission. And so this koan has historical importance for Zen. But the question is, if it's Dharma transmission, what gets transmitted? What did the Buddha actually give to Mahakashyapa? When people work on this koan, you might have various motives for working on this koan and working on the koan or practicing Zen. So it's definitely the case that when some people work on this koan, they would like to be Mahakashyapa. We all would like to be Mahakashyapa in a certain way. You know, at least some of us. When I started practicing Zen with Genki Roshi, I wanted to be a really good Zen student, the same way I had been a good student in my classes, you know. So when I was in my classes, the teacher would ask a question, and I was always one of the first people in the class to have his hand up. So the teacher would ask a question, and there would go my hand. And usually I had the answer, you know, because I worked really hard in my studies. And the teacher would call on me, and I would feel acknowledged, like I knew what I was doing, and it was a good feeling. Now that I'm a teacher, I appreciate those students somewhat, you know, because if I ask a question, I have a student in one of my classes right now, she's a very intelligent woman, and if I ask a question, her hand is up right away. And I'll call on her, and she'll give a really great answer. And then I'll, go on to the next question, and I'll ask the question, and her hand will go up right away. And she'll give a really good answer. And everybody else is sort of getting more and more quiet, see? And sort of like, it's like, okay, I'll pitch the ball to her, and she'll hit it out of the park, and then I'll pitch another ball to her. You know, I kind of feel like saying after class, listen, don't answer all the questions. You know, give other people a chance. Not as fast on the draw as she is. She's very well prepared and very smart. It takes other people in the class time to figure it out, you know. So I'm very glad she's in the class, because if she weren't there, sometimes you throw the question out and nobody answers. And after a while you answer it yourself, you know, which is kind of a defeat if you're a teacher. But if you have a student who's too ready on the draw with the hand, you know, then the other students don't get a chance to be confused or to be struggling, which is what you want them to be. You know, if they don't know the answer, it's okay. They could give an answer that could be improved, you know. And if somebody gives an answer that's okay, but it's not the best answer, you know, the teacher loves that opportunity to say, okay, well, let's think about that. You know, you push it a little farther and you take your students through the learning process, you know. I always wanted to be, have my hand up. And I always wanted to have the teacher recognize me. And it made me feel good. You know, I felt like, yeah, I'm a really good student, see. So we all have that desire to be good at what we do and to be recognized. It's a perfectly natural human desire. So, when we work with this koan, there might be a part of you that, you know, would like to put yourself in a Mahakashapa's place. You'd like to have the Buddha see you and say, of all the 1,000 people here today, you know, Mahakashapa is the one who has to whom I'm transmitting the Dharma. I'm transmitting, he must be deeply, you know, you would think he must be deeply awake. So, you know, that's okay. That is a perfectly human thing to want to be noticed, to want to be good at what you do. You know, a few years ago at Rutgers, there was an opportunity for everybody in my department to put themselves up for a little bit of a raise. And you had to type up an account of all the different things you've done over the last 4 years, like papers given, articles published. Type it all up and submit it, and then a committee will award small raises. Not a lot of money, but in fact, it was very small amount of money. But it still felt good to have somebody recognize my accomplishments. You know. And the raise was so small that you wouldn't notice it in any paycheck, right? But it doesn't matter. I just felt good getting a letter saying, you know, in honor of your hard work, we're offering you this tiny microscopic promotion, right? And I was happy to get it, not because of the money, but because of the recognition, you know. So it's normal and healthy. So when people work with this koan, you know, the first thing they often do when they work with this koan is to put themselves in Mahakashapa's position, you know. And they would like to be... I definitely had many fantasies when I first started doing Zen that I would be this amazing student, and that Genki Roshi would... say, oh my gosh, you know, you're the reincarnation of my old teacher, you know, it's wonderful to see you again, Master, you know, and he never said that to me. Mostly he said, keep working on your koan, you'll get it, you know. So I had a lot of fantasies, you know, when I started doing Zen, and this koan is really some part of this koan is really speaking to that. You know, there's a part of our efforts, whether it's in Zen or anything else, which is motivated by this healthy desire for recognition. But you know, sometimes that can get in the way. You know, that can become a problem. You know, we become too hungry for recognition, too needy, little too dependent on other people's acknowledgement of our achievements. You know, in the Diamond Sutra, it actually says that if a bodhisattva has the thought, a being who has broken through to an enlightened state of mind, if a bodhisattva has the thought, I have broken through to an enlightened state of mind, I am now a bodhisattva, that is not a bodhisattva. Isn't that interesting? It also says, if a Buddha says, I am the Buddha, I have achieved Buddhahood, that being is not a Buddha. And what the sutra, such an important passage in the sutra, what it means is that people who are really deeply awake don't reflect on being really deeply awake. You know? Come from that place. They don't act or exist in that place. You know, the great Zen master Dogen, Japanese master, said to practice Zen is to study the self. That's what we do when we sit down on the cushion and we discover and work through our mental obstacles, right? That what to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. That's stage two. See, so, you know, stage three is to become one with all things. So, you know, in the case of a being who said, you know, darn it, I've made it. I'm a bodhisattva. The Diamond Sutra says that person is not a bodhisattva. Because people who are deeply awake don't cling to their identity that way. They don't, they're not trying to be a person in that way anymore. You know? If you practice Zen, and it's only natural sometimes to practice Zen with an eye to becoming a bodhisattva, an enlightened being. That's a perfectly good thing. But, you know, if you stop to say, you know, I've been practicing Zen for 4 years and I'm still not enlightened, that's a kind of thinking that shows that you're not enlightened, right? Bodhisattvas don't reflect on themselves and make judgments about themselves, either positive or negative. They just keep going from moment to moment, see? They're just in the flow of events. And their motive is basically helping others, see? So a bodhisattva doesn't think, I'm a bodhisattva, the Diamond Sutra says. And the Diamond Sutra says, a Buddha doesn't stop to think, you know, darn it, I'm finally there. I'm a Buddha. Because if such a being had those thoughts, they wouldn't be a Buddha. Now, we all have those thoughts, right? I mean, we all have times where, especially when I first started doing Zen, I really wanted to be acknowledged by my teacher. I wanted my teacher to look at me and say, you know, you are a really excellent Zen student. You're really making progress. Good work. Enlightenment is right around the corner for you, you see. I mean, it's only natural in a certain way to want that. But actually, in Zen, traditionally, Zen doesn't do that to people. Because it doesn't want you to act from that place. In this koan, when Master Mumon makes his comment, Master Mumon is the editor of this collection of koans. So after I read the koan itself about the Buddha holding up the flower, there's a commentary by Master Mumon, Master Umen. Umen says, golden-faced Gotama really disregarded his listeners. He made the good look bad and he sold dog meat labeled as mutton. He himself thought it was wonderful. If, however, the audience had laughed, and he goes on. See, he's very negative or disparaging. And he does this all the time. This is part of Zen practice saying, you know, don't get attached to how you size yourself up or how others size yourself up. A bodhisattva doesn't think about himself that way, either positively or negatively. You know, a few years ago I ran into an old friend and he said, you know, I've been practicing Zen for 20 years and I'm still not awake. And he said it with a lot of self-pity and I felt so sorry for him. Because, you know, if he could just get rid of that thought of himself, you know, he might have said, you know, I've been practicing Zen for 20 years and so many wonderful moments in my practice. You know, I remember, practicing with him when I was sitting in a temple here in New York. And it was a winter day and it was snowing, not here in New York, but in New York. It was snow. It was a beautiful session. The snow was coming down. You know, the air was dry and crisp. It's up in the Catskills. And there were, it was just, you know, beautiful. This temple has a gong. You know, they, in the morning they ring this gong. It's so beautiful. Everybody's sitting. It's early morning. It's in the middle of nowhere, so it's a very still, quiet place, surrounded by wildlife. The gong strikes. You know, at night they have what's called a han. It hangs from the wall of the temple, and it's a wooden, it's a very thick piece of wood that you strike with a wooden mallet at the end of the day. And at the end of the day, listening to this monk strike the han, so beautiful, you know. And many, many times, you know, you could hear winter birds outside the temple, you know, busily chattering. And sometimes the sound of sleet on the windows, you know, wind. So many beautiful things when we forget the self, you know. And this person, this friend of mine, you know, he wasn't thinking of any of those. All he was thinking was that he had been practicing Zen for 20 years, and he hadn't gotten a merit badge or some kind of recognition. You know, and so that's really sad, you know, but it's human. We all, especially in the modern world, you know, we tend to measure ourselves against other people and against ourselves, right? So you know, we're raised to be competitors. You know, I'm a teacher, and you know, I don't give everybody an A. In my classes, there's a curve, and my students are quite used to that. They've been evaluated and competitors since they were in the first grade. But nevertheless, you know, it's a real trap to bring that mentality to your practice. What am I getting out of this? You know, what kind of recognition am I getting for this, right? You know, am I making progress? Those are all human questions. You know, if you've been practicing for 10 years, it's a human response to say, where is this, what am I getting out of this, right? But you know, as soon as you think that way, you know, you forget what you've gotten out of it. You know, as soon as the self becomes the focus, everything else disappears. And the real liberating experience at the heart of Zen becomes hard to see. You know, so part of this koan is dealing with this issue. You know, when you are given a koan like this, you know, when Shakyamuni Buddha was at Mount Grivrakuta, Vulture Peak, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent. Only Mahakashapa broke out into a broad smile, right? And the Buddha then says, "You've got it, my man. You've done it, you know. Here's the payoff, right?" It's a moment that's very tempting. It's tempting to want to be Mahakashapa. But don't fall into that koan's trap, please. You know, realize that in another koan, there's a famous story about, in Japanese, he's called Ekko. And he is the first student of Bodhidharma, the Indian monk who brought Zen to China. And he waits in the snow outside of Bodhidharma's cave, trying to convince Bodhidharma to accept him as a student. So Bodhidharma is living in a cave where he's meditating by himself, and Shinko, I'm sorry, is his name, shows up and says, "I want to be your student." And Bodhidharma says, "Well, I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure. I'll think about it." And so Shinko sits in the snow, and to demonstrate his loyalty, he cuts off his arm. It's a metaphor. Don't cut off your arm. Mm-hmm. After he cuts off his arm, Bodhidharma says, "You know, you didn't have to cut off your arm. I'm just looking for a person who doesn't look to others for approval. See? I just wanted to see that if you didn't get my approval, would you stick around?" See, and you know, if I don't give you my approval, will you stick around or will you go? And if you go when you don't get the approval, see, it's like you're in a world of ghosts for the rest of your life, because you're not acting from the right place, right? So looking to others for approval is a natural human thing, but beware of it as a motivation that can take over your life, and it especially can poison your practice. You know, in some Zen temples, believe it or not, out in California at one time in Maizumi Roshi's temple, they would actually post the names at the end of sesshin of people who had passed their koans. This is a terrible idea, in my opinion. And it should never have been done. What it's encouraging is competitiveness, and also, like, you know, people sitting around going, God, how come everybody else is... To practice Zen is to forget the self. To forget the self, to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. So putting people's names on a wall and their koan and past or not past actually makes people very self-conscious. And it's not a good idea. And it will poison your practice. And at some temples, actually different levels of student get different indications of this on their robe, like in martial arts, right? This is very bad idea. You know, one of my favorite movies is The Karate Kid. It's very dated now, but I love that movie. And the teacher is an Okinawan man who is trying to show this, who has moved to the United States, and he's trying to help this kid become a martial artist. And the kid asks him, what kind of belt do you have? And he means, do you have a black belt? He says, I have a belt to hold up my pants. And that's the spirit, right? That's a good spirit. Not to make, you know, different colored rakusus is another way of creating the wrong spirit. Forget the self. So the first part of this koan is really like a trap for the student. You know, instead of paying attention to the koan, you pay attention to the honors heaped on Mahakashapa, right? And you might think, gee, I would like to be Mahakashapa. You know, there are actually people who practice Zen in that spirit, believe it or not. You know, there are people who, you know, really see this as a chance to distinguish themselves and make a name for themselves and so on. Very, very bad motivation, even though we all have some of that, right? I definitely had that when I started practicing Zen, that fantasy of being told, ah, you finally have it. See, enlightenment is not about finally having it. It's about finally letting go. Finally letting go of the desire to have it. Finally letting go of the desire to be recognized, you know. See, I mean, in the Diamond Sutra, just to get back to that sutra, you know, at the end of the sutra, the Buddha says, you know, life is like a lightning flash and it's over. And, you know, when you're young, it doesn't seem that way. You know, especially, I can remember being 14 and it just, or actually I can remember being like 10 and I wanted to be 14. Right, so badly. And, you know, it just seemed like, am I 14 yet? Am I 14 yet? You know, it was just like, oh my God, I'm still 10. You know, this is taking forever. You know. But as you get closer to the other side of your life, you know, you look back and you say, oh my God, was that 40 years ago? You know, it's just like that. So, you know, our human lives are extremely, they're like the, as the Buddha said, they're like a flash of lightning on a summer day. It's just a blink, and it's gone. You know, so, in 50 years, you know, people will say, Elon Musk. You know, everybody go, Elon Musk? What's that? Is that a dessert? People won't even know who Elon... the great artists of our time, people will... These just become footnotes in the library, you know? Everything we are, it disappears very quickly. You know, everything we do disappears very quickly. You know, even if you leave your descendants a photo, you know, photos decay. In a couple of generations, it's gone. You know, so living for that is a formula for unhappiness, first of all. Setting a goal and then failing to meet it because it's the wrong goal is a formula for unhappiness. But you know, if we understand that the impermanence really is everything in life, then you know, trying to quote be somebody is a really unhealthy way to live. You know, so this koan is sort of setting us up to have the wrong thoughts about this event. You know, it's saying if you're an English professor, your fantasy is you're going to write a book. And the Modern Language Association of America is going to say, this is the best book this year. Come to our annual conference and get the award, you know? And you'll stand on a podium and they'll say, this is a great book. You are a genius. Here you are. Here's your award, right? You know, that's human. That's why we have these events, and it's not a terrible thing. But it becomes a prison. Because, you know, there's 1,000 other books that didn't get that award, and, you know, in 20 years, none of them might be remembered, or the one that didn't get the reward is going to be remembered, you know. So it's very important not to practice from that place. Use your practice to forget the self. When you sit down on the cushion, forget the self. And when you forget the self, you become one with the 10,000 things. See, as individuals, we all are here today and gone tomorrow. But when we sit down on the cushion and we enter deep samadhi, you know, we begin to feel connected to everything around us. See, this is the deathless. This is the deathless. You know, this, and it's so wonderful to have that feeling. You know, on day 3 of Sesshin, you know, people suddenly they enter the Buddha actually called enlightened state of mind the deathless. It's interesting, and that was the word he used, and he also sometimes called it the unborn and the deathless. So you know, when you're on day 3 of Sesshin and you've been forgetting the self for 3 days, you go outside, and especially in the summer, you know, suddenly it's just like every flower, every blade of grass is distinct and present to you. And the boundary between yourself and everything around you has greatly diminished if it hasn't totally disappeared. And everything is so alive, and you're alive with it. See, nothing exists by itself. You know, basic teaching of the Dharma is called dependent origination, or dependent co-arising. See, you can't have grass without soil. You can't have grass without oxygen. You can't have oxygen without certain things, and you can't have... So you need water, you need clouds, you need dirt to have grass, right? And humans can't exist without the things they... It's a complex web. It's like the web of existence. And nothing can exist by itself. You know, the problem is that when we're so obsessed with ourselves, when our minds are focused too much on ourselves... You know, we lose sight of this interconnectedness. See, we lose sight. Then it's all about studying the self and the concerns of the self. And that world gets smaller and smaller all the time. That's the world of comparisons with others, critical self-judgment, and so on. You know, they have done studies of they've done psychological profiles of people who are quite distinguished, like super geniuses, right? Like Einstein and Newton. And psychologists say they have one thing in common, you know, they don't worry. They have great deal of self-confidence. They don't think about themselves much at all. They actually don't think about themselves. They're very absorbed in what they're doing, is the point, you know. So apparently Einstein didn't come home and go, geez, I didn't get the Nobel. You know, I must be slipping. You know, what's wrong with me? Why can't I focus, you know? I'm not really a good physicist. Maybe I should have stayed in the patent office. And, you know, they also find that, you know, people who have, people with certain kinds of, like, people who are very neurotic and have, you know, much higher rates of self-referencing in their mental processing. So they're constantly thinking about themselves. And that produces a number of other sort of disorders. So, you know, people like Einstein or Newton, you know, they're just caught up in what they're doing. This person said they're serenely engaged. I love that phrase, serenely engaged. You know? And so, you know, if a challenge happens and you're focused on yourself, it becomes a threat. But if a challenge happens and you're serenely engaged, see, it's a completely different experience. This koan is kind of setting us up. It's speaking to that part of us which is hungry for recognition, hungry for approval, and feels not good enough, see. And it's sort of this moment of, and now finally you're recognized. So, like so many koans, this has a bit of a hook or a bit of a trap. But there's this other side of the koan, which is so wonderful that people miss if they're caught with that aspect of the koan. You know, the Buddha walks up to Vulture Peak and he holds up a flower. See? You know, if you haven't done a lot of zazen, you don't know what to do with this, right? I mean, you know, you don't know the secret of seeing, actually. You know, sometimes people see, they figure it out on their own, right? But the secret of seeing is emptiness, you know? So, you know, if you're on your way to work, and it's a summer day, and you're worried about all the things you have to do, you could be walking through a flower garden and you wouldn't see a single one of those flowers. Or if you did see a flower, if you paused, you might go, you know, you might look and say, oh, that's pretty. And then you jump in your car and you drive off to work. And I've had many days like that, you know. I just can't, you know. And later somebody might have said, did you see the flower garden? And you might say, did I? Was that this morning? Was that last week? You know, your state of mind was quite distanced from everything around you. You know, so that's sort of everyday state of mind. That's our ordinary state of mind. It does happen that occasionally, you know, you're in a hurry and you look and you see something so beautiful. It just stops your thinking process, and you suddenly enter samadhi naturally. That definitely happens to people. It can be a flower, it can be a tree, it can be something else. I was at a conference last week, and I went to a museum, and they had a show on Pablo Picasso and African art. And it was so interesting because we don't really realize how much Picasso was influenced by African art. But in the museum, they actually have a quotation from him. And he said, The greatest event in my life was when I went to a museum and saw African art. And it absolutely, you know, basically he said it absolutely blew me away, you know. And I'm sure that he had one of these moments where he walked into this anthropological museum in Paris and he looked at these masks and it literally, it stopped his thinking process, right? And he was simply 100% present in the moment. With the he became the masks, you know. And for the rest of his life, if you look at his paintings, you realize he's painting these African masks, you know, again and again and again. Because that was his insight into liberation, you know. And so you know, when we normally look at a flower, we're really seeing it very poorly, because its presence is screened off to us by all of our thoughts and concerns, by the self. And, you know, when we go to Sesshin and we sit for 3 days, or if we sit on a Saturday, all morning on a Saturday, and you go outside and you see the blue, blue sky or the snow on the ground, you know, there's no distance now between you and what you see. You become what you see. See? And the way to get to that place is actually, we Zen people believe, through emptiness. See? So you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we watch our breath, you know, at first you're just watching your breath, and it's very difficult to do that. So if you're just starting Zen practice, that's too challenging, because your mind keeps filling all the spaces with your thoughts. So you watch the breath, and then there's thoughts. And then you watch the breath, and there's thoughts. And there's so many thoughts that you can't even focus on the breath. In Chinese Zen, they always use the metaphor of vines, entangling vines for thoughts. You know, I don't know if you've ever... planted sweet potatoes, but you can take a sweet potato, if you have a big jar, you can take a sweet potato and put toothpicks in the bottom of the sweet potato, or you could put it in a bowl too. And you take the sweet potato, you put it in a bowl full of water so that the head is sticking out of the water. And every day in the summer, that sweet potato will produce vines. And the vines grow, like, I'm not kidding, they will grow 4 inches in a day. And you know, in no time at all, you'll have this profuse, beautiful bunch of vines. In ancient China, these were used to for animal feed, actually, you know. And people would eat them too, but they're cheap animal feed. But the Zen masters would use the metaphor of these creepers or vines. You know, and it's so true, you know, when you're sitting down on the cushion and you're watching your breath, you know, thoughts arise. It's so hard to get to a place where the thoughts don't arise. And once one thought arises, it's just like it proliferates, right? Suddenly, it's like a sweet potato. All of a sudden, there's 1,000 tendrils extending across the whole countertop. You know, So part of Zen practice is to cut the creepers off, cut the little vine off before it proliferates. So when the shoot comes out, you cut it off. So you're watching the breath and the thought starts, but you don't let it go. You don't let it proliferate. You cut it off. So you follow the first breath out and you cut it off. You follow the second, if you just focus on the breath, it's like a little snipper. You snip away all your thoughts. After a while, you know, you get to a very deep place, and eventually you'll notice that you're focusing on the breath quite without obstruction, and then you'll notice that sometimes the breath seems to disappear, or at the end of the breath, there's a blankness, right? And this is what we call wu, or mu, mu xin, wu xin, right? Empty, mind of emptiness. This is so important because we want to focus, we want to immerse ourselves deeply in the samadhi of Ushin, the samadhi of shunyata. And if you go deeply into the samadhi of shunyata, it purifies body, heart, and mind. And then, you know, after a period of meditation, when you get off the cushion, you're no longer focused on the self. You have this unobstructed experience of the world around you. In Buddhism, this experience is very highly valued. There's actually a word for it. It's called in Sanskrit, it's called tat-ata. It means presentness. See, presentness is so pure presentness. You are at one with the world around you, at one with. So this koan is, making a statement. You know, why are we not at one with the world around? The Buddha holds up a flower. Everybody else is thinking, you know, some people are watching the Buddha and they're waiting for him to speak and they're thinking, come on, I've got to get back, you know. And some people are thinking, this is not how it's supposed to be. You know, I've come up here. I'm supposed to get a lecture. Why am I not getting a lecture? You know, and somebody else is thinking, oh, brother, you know, I'm late with my rent payment. And somebody else is thinking, I didn't get a promotion. Why? Why? You know, life is so unfair, you know, and so on and so on. And human tragedies, too. People are having thoughts about being sick. People have toothaches. A million different things. So, you know, the Buddha holds up a flower, but nobody else can nobody can focus. Nobody can be present. Nobody can be experience tat-ata at that moment, except for Mahakashyapa. And Mahakashyapa experiences the world as himself. See, one with. And he smiles. And the Buddha wants people to discover this for themselves. He doesn't want, at least in this koan, we don't really know what the Buddha said. But in the koan, you know, koans are supposed to help you wake up. So in the Mumon, who put the koan in the book, didn't give an explanation like I just did. He gave you an explanation that would mislead you a little bit. So you can discover for yourself what confusion is and what liberation from confusion is, which is sort of the Zen way of teaching. You know, don't look to others, find it yourself. When Shakyamuni Buddha was at Mount Gridhrakuta, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent. They just couldn't figure it out, huh? Only Mahakashyapa broke into a broad smile because he was in deep mushin. The Buddha said, I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, the subtle Dharma gate, independent of words, and transmitted beyond doctrine. This is actually true. I mean, the Buddha's saying, my way lies beyond words, right? And I have entrusted to Mahakashyapa. But he doesn't have to. Mahakashyapa's already there. Mumon's comment, golden-faced Gautama really disregarded his listeners. He made the good look bad and he sold dog meat labeled as mutton. He himself thought it was wonderful. However, if everyone in the audience had laughed, how could he have transmitted the true eye? And again, if Mahakashyapa hadn't smiled, how could the Buddha have transmitted it? If you say that the true eye of Dharma cannot be transmitted, then that golden-faced old man would be a city slicker who cheats the country bumpkins. If you say it cannot be transmitted, then why did the Buddha approve of Mahakashyapa? Mumon's verse, holding out a flower, the Buddha revealed he has a curly tail. This is Mumon's way of saying, basically, the Buddha is teaching in a very clever way. Heaven and earth were bewildered at Mahakashapa's smile.